I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody, and welcome along to the very first Drive Nation podcast, something we've been threatening to do for a little while. But given everything that's going on at the moment, this COVID-19 situation, we've decided now is probably a good time to see if we can get the DN podcast off the ground. I'm Dan Prosser, co-founder of Drive Nation, co-host of this podcast. Now, there's a lot of housekeeping stuff that I want to get through, explaining what this podcast is going to be all about, the format of it, and all that stuff. But none of it's more important than introducing to you my Drive Nation co-host and co-founder, Andrew Frankel.
Hello, one and all. I am indeed Andrew Frankel, and I'm very glad that you are currently tuned into our first podcast. We are flying a bit blind here. It's not something I've done a lot of. But you know, given that we have time on our hands, and given that it is, as Dan says, something that we have really wanted to do for quite a while, hopefully it'll be worthwhile. Hopefully we will tell you a few things you maybe didn't know, hopefully be a little bit entertaining, and hopefully you won't get too bored too soon.
Strange times at the moment, I would say. This COVID-19 situation, it's cancelling events left, right and centre. It's having an impact on every industry you can imagine, but it's probably given us time to sit down and have a go at this. We're being very careful. We're 3 meters apart. No handshakes. No symptoms.
Not yet. Early days.
So we're taking precautions. As has been mentioned already, this very much is a trial run. It's a pilot episode of the DN podcast. We're using borrowed equipment, and we're indebted to our friend Neil Carey for that. Neil, when we're allowed back in the pubs, you've got several beers coming your way. We would like the DN podcast to become a regular thing. The response to this pilot podcast will give us some idea if there's any appetite for a more regular podcast. So please do get in touch with us if you've listened to this and you thought it wasn't completely terrible. If you'd like to hear more, we will record more.
Yeah, I'd also say, yeah, we are always, as in the stuff that we write, we are always open to ideas. I think probably the single greatest joy that DM brings Dan and me is the interaction that we have with you guys, and I do mean that entirely sincerely. It's why we do try to get back to a large number of all the stuff that you post, because quite often, frankly, it's more interesting than the stuff that we write. So if there are themes, if there are ideas, subjects, whatever that you would like to hear us extemporize about on a slightly longer, broader format than is possible within the confines of Instagram, then please tell us. We'll have a look at it, and we'll get, time is not a limit here, so one way or the other, we'll get through as much of it as we can.
Andrew, we're sat in one of your front rooms.
One of the many front rooms.
And one of the ways in which I was going to get this conversation onto cars is to ask you about the car or cars you've got parked outside. At the moment, I can only see a Golf.
You can only see a Golf. Okay, that's interesting. Yes, that's because test cars aren't exactly to a penny at the moment. I don't have any other test cars at the moment. And so the Golf is my wife's Golf. It's our family runabout. I do have a shed with a few old, unimportant things in it. My daughter probably is in her Toyota Aygo at the moment. And yeah, that's about it.
So we're all well aware of the coronavirus situation at the moment. Now, you weren't supposed to be here this week.
No, I wasn't. No, I was meant to be. I was meant to be in America. I was meant to be driving the 911 Turbo, which probably would have been fun because it involved Monterey and Laguna Seca and skidding around one of America's annoyingly large number of fantastic racetracks. But in fact, I find myself sit here stuck in a room talking to you. But there you go.
Right. Now, let me quickly, before we get stuck into it, let me explain what I want the format of this podcast to be. Now, I tend to prefer free-flowing or rambling discussions. I'd prefer that podcast format to a very structured, heavily formatted one. And so that's what we're going to aim for, albeit with a certain degree of structure to it, not too much. I think what I want the first chunk of the podcast to be is a free-flowing chat about the latest goings-on, that whether that's motorsport or new cars or news or whatever it is. I think I want the first sort of 20 minutes or so to be Andrew and I just chatting rubbish about the latest goings on. After that, there will be another section of the podcast, a distinct section of the podcast, which I think actually could be quite interesting. Now, presumably, if you've stumbled upon this podcast, it's because you know about Drive Nation and you know what Drive Nation is. If you don't, let me briefly explain. Andrew and I like to think of it as a digital car magazine that exists only on Instagram. So we do everything that a car magazine website would do, but we package it in a way that suits Instagram, and it's short form and it's bite size. And our readers seem to enjoy what we do. We post car reviews, reviews of older cars, car news, opinions, interviews, features, all of that stuff. If you haven't seen Drive Nation on Instagram, please go and have a look. It's at DriveNation _. Andrew, what's your elevator pitch for DN?
I think it's, you know, looking at Instagram as, you know, one of the largest media platforms out there. And there is, until we came along, there was absolutely nobody doing what I may loosely refer to as proper car journalism on it. And you're kind enough to ask me for my pitch. As people probably don't know, Drive Nation was entirely Dan's idea, and he very kindly came to me with it and asked me what I thought of it. And I just, as a person who's been doing this for, I think, genuinely longer than Dan's been alive, and someone who was brought up very much in the traditions of motoring journalism, I mean, the first stories I ever wrote, I wrote on a thing called a typewriter. And I just liked the idea of broadening my horizons a bit, frankly, doing something that's a bit different. I mean, I've written lots of magazine stories, I've written a few books, but in fact, the discipline of doing something like Drive Nation, you know, every single day, but also writing to that length, and doing it in such a way that, you know, every single text page that you see, you know, ends with a full stop, nothing ever runs over. It's an interesting discipline. It's quite difficult to write about cars in a way that is hopefully informative, hopefully entertaining, while sticking to that length. But it is, as I said, it is a great discipline. It's a good challenge. And so far, at least, from the numbers of you who have joined up and are kind enough to follow what we do and comment on what we say, it seems to be working.
Exactly that. So, yeah, I think we apply good, old-fashioned, rigorous car journalism to Instagram and have fun while doing it. And I think, broadly, that's what I want the podcast to be as well. And so the second section of the podcast is going to be Andrew and I discussing the previous week's most popular Drive Nation posts in a bit more detail. And I think that will work really nicely. It'll mean that the podcast is varied. It'll mean that it's topical. There'll be lots of depth in there. So again, let us know what you think of that idea. Once you've listened to this podcast, if you feel like you want to get in touch, please let us know whether or not you think that's a good idea. First part of the podcast, though, is we're going to do a little bit of a news chat. Now, we're in this weird paradoxical situation where there is no car news except for the biggest news of the year, which is this whole COVID-19 outbreak. I mean, Andrew, have you ever experienced anything like this?
No, I don't think any of us have. I mean, I think the only thing it can be compared to is the war. Not even I'm old enough to remember that. No, I think within the sort of living adult lifetimes of almost all of us, it is the biggest, for want of a better word, catastrophe that has befallen us. And let's hope that that's the way that it remains, and that nothing even more horrendous comes along. As for the industry, I know it's terribly doom and gloom at the moment. And as we are recording this, it seems to me that certainly every day, almost sometimes every hour, some new catastrophic piece of information about further restrictions to what we can and cannot do comes out. I think it's very easy to get very down in the mouth about this. I think two things will happen. Firstly, there will become quite shortly a new normal, which will be less terrifying and more profoundly boring, where most of us just find ourselves unable to do what we need to do. Obviously, lots of people are going to be struggling to earn livings as well, which is going to be worrying particularly for motoring journalists, and I'm sure lots of other people in the industry as well as other industries, because, motoring journalists, unless you're very big and on the telly, you're never going to earn, you'll have a great time, but you're never going to earn a huge amount of money doing it. So, that's an interesting challenge, but everybody's got those challenges. I think and I hope that in time it will start to improve and life will return to normal. And I think the big question is that once life has returned to normal, how changed is it? Mm. Is globalization still going to be the thing? Are we really going to be running around the planet in the same way that we were? Or are we going to find that in this huge amounts of downtime that we have, we're going to find things that actually do quite work well for us, not going out quite as much as we used to? And what impact does that have on the car industry, on car sales, on how people go about their business in the car world and international racing? I mean, it's an enormous subject, and we can't begin for a moment to suppose that we have any of the answers. But I can't imagine for a moment that even once this is done, we're not going to be somehow and quite fundamentally changed by it.
I completely agree. So where are we now? We're recording this on the 19th of March, and what have we had so far? We've had the start of the Formula One season delayed, the Australian Grand Prix cancelled.
Bahrain and Vietnam.
Exactly.
Le Mans pushed back to September.
I think the N24 as well. We've had multiple car factory shutdowns.
Yeah.
And that's open-ended as well.
Yes.
So the industry, the interesting, or perhaps the worrying thing about this from the industry's point of view, and we both accept that there are many, many more important things to consider than the state of the car industry during this whole crisis. It was only 2 years ago that the whole WLTP thing happened throughout 2018, and certain manufacturers were almost brought down to their knees by that. I think Adrian Hallmark, Bentley CEO, has said that for half the year, in half their markets, half their models weren't being
correct
sold.
Yeah.
They had a horrible time of it.
Just on that, I think, Adrian will probably correct me, but I think the Continental GT was launched in 18. I don't think they sold any in America in 2019. That's an entire year's worth of production in your largest market that just didn't happen.
They had a torrid time of it. And then in 2019, from a British point of view, there was a huge amount of uncertainty because of Brexit. And so off the back of WLTP, off the back of Brexit, all the car manufacturers were looking at 2020 as being the bounce back year where things would hopefully really get going again. And now that's all just been put back who knows how long by this horrible situation.
Yeah, and I would say more than put back. I mean, I think that, I fear that WLTP will appear like a minor inconvenience compared to the number of people in factories that may lose their jobs over this, the amount of revenues that companies like Aston Martin. Now, luckily, thanks to Lawrence Stroll, they've had a big injection of cash, which hopefully will shore them up for some time to come. But these must be precarious times for companies, and we just have to keep our fingers crossed that they survive. And also, I feel really, really sorry for companies like Zinger, who are going to go to the Geneva show and launch this amazing new hypercar made out of 3D printed material. And they have been left completely high and dry by this. Their big Yahoo moment, through absolutely no fault of their own, just ripped away from under their noses. And, you know, I, from what I can see from their social media, they seem to be a fairly resilient bunch and appear to be going about it in the right way. But, you know, it must be scary times for them and plenty of others.
Absolutely. And the concerning thing is it's not just an inconvenience, or it doesn't just set back their business plan. There's a very real chance that it does lasting damage.
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
It's so interesting hearing you talk, Andrew, about how this might change our mindset moving forward. And one thing that I just wanted to raise with you is you and I have both done this a lot. We'll be flown by a car manufacturer for a new car launch out to California or the Middle East or wherever it might be.
I hope you're all feeling very sorry for us.
Yeah, we're fishing for sympathy here. But we're going out there to drive cars that are built within 100 miles or 200 miles of where we live.
Oh, we've done that, haven't we? You know, so yes, it's, you know, it's 5 days, and you know, the idea obviously of going to California and spending 5 days, you know, driving around Laguna Seca or whatever, you know, no one's going to feel sorry for us. But as freelance journalists, time is literally money. We don't get paid to drive cars; we get paid to write about them. And so sometimes you've thought, well, could we not just go to, you know, somewhere in the Midlands where these things are built? And apparently that's not possible because they're not on the right fleet, or they're not on the right part of the production schedule or whatever. So we have to go halfway around the world to drive them. That kind of has to change, doesn't it? But then again, what do the people who are already halfway around, how do they get to drive the cars?
Well, that's the thing. That is the thing. I sometimes wonder if I should impose a personal rule on myself that I won't fly long haul to drive a car that's built within a 3-4 hour drive of my house. You know, I think, and I just wonder if the result of this COVID-19 thing and people not traveling around quite so much is that people don't travel around quite so much. You know, are we going to change our attitudes to how we jet across the world for things that perhaps aren't entirely necessary?
Yes, I think ultimately, yes. And in our business, I can think of no more likely candidate for that than the motor show. Mm. You know, obviously motor shows have two, you know, legs to them effectively. There's the press and the PR side of it, and then there's the customer side of it. And if it's a selling show, then I guess that there is still, you know, a good reason for having it. But, you know, I have some idea of what it costs to put on a decent stand at a big international show, a Geneva or a Beijing or something like that. And it is millions and millions. And I think, frankly, the whole debacle over Geneva, which has left a lot of manufacturers, you know, A, considerably out of pocket, but B, substantially cheesed off with what they feel has been some, what's the word? I don't think they feel they have been well treated by a show which they have supported for many, many years. And I think that it's just short-sighted because, you know, if you look at the big shows around the world, Detroit is a shadow of its former self. So is Tokyo. Frankfurt isn't even happening next year. We wait to be told what sort of show it's going to be and where it's going to be. Paris, is the list of no-shows at Paris just gets longer and longer every year. And if I was Geneva, I would be doing everything in my power to make sure that the manufacturers were reassured, reimbursed, and kept as on-site as humanly possible. Because I think these guys are looking for an excuse to give it up. And it's possible they've just been given one.
It's very interesting, isn't it? It would be a shame for me if they all went under. If one had to survive, surely, though, it would be Geneva. Because it's towards the start of the new year. It's on neutral ground. It's in Europe, surrounded by a couple of dozen enormous OEMs. You know, it's a well-attended show. It's not too difficult to get around. It's actually one of the most sort of accessible on foot as a visitor. Some of the other shows are enormous, but Geneva is not one. Do you think we could do away with all the others and hold on to Geneva and perhaps a couple of other regional ones? Or will they ultimately all have the same fate?
I think they need to get smaller and they need to get more affordable. You know, I've just had a bit of a go at the show, but in fact, you know, the manufacturers are just as angry with, for instance, the hotel trade in Geneva, who insist on you block booking rooms for a week, even if you may only need them for, you know, a night or two. And none of them are offering refunds. It's the same with people who have made expensive bookings at restaurants and everything else. And I think that the static motor show, I mean, these things sort of came about, you know, in the 1930s because it was the only way the public got to see interesting new cars. Well, it's, you know, we're 70, 80 years further down the line than that. And, you know, and we have seen with things like the Goodwood Festival of Speed, just, you know, Goodwood, if you think about it, is geographically in a pretty terrible position for holding a motor show. It's down some tiny little lanes, tucked away in the southeast corner of England. And yet, you know, people flock to it. Manufacturers spend a lot of money because people can get to the cars. They see them actually in action. It's a very convivial way of doing it. And at the end of the day, you can go home and look it all up again on the internet and watch, you know, every run happen all over again. All this stuff you just can't do at a conventional show. And you know, my view is that, you know, I will continue to go to shows while I'm required to, while there's business to be done there. But to me, they're an anachronism. I think the world's just moved on.
Apart from everything else, apart from all the damage this situation will do, it might also be the catalyst for some change that has been quite slow coming.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, a few boring old farts like me have been banging on about this for a while now. And again, you can't prejudge any situation, and you know, the industry is absolutely fantastic at, you know, failing to learn lessons, and you know, in a year's time it may be Groundhog Day and we're all back again and it's like it never happened. But this is so big, this is so different. These waters are entirely uncharted, and as I said earlier, I'd be very surprised if, you know, cash-strapped manufacturers, as they all will be, big or small, by the end of this, aren't going to be looking very, very carefully at everything that they spend. And if there's any question mark over anything, you know, I know that lots of manufacturers very creatively had virtual motor shows where they launch cars online from their own, you know, head offices. And they will have the metrics on that. They will know how many people tuned in. They will know, they will be able to compare directly what the response to that has been compared to the response of doing a show. I'm sure it will be down. But if it's not down by as much as it costs to put on a show, then maybe you'll think, well, that's the way we'll do it in future.
Well, there we go. If there was any other news in the car industry at the moment, we'd discuss it now. But there isn't any.
No.
That's just about it, isn't it? So let's move on to the second part of the podcast, which is where we deep dive a handful of our recent Drive Nation posts. Now, Andrew, I've pulled out one in particular for you because it got such a great response and people just loved reading about your adventure in 1993, I think it was, in a Ford Mondeo.
Oh, God, yes.
So can you remind us, please, what that was all about?
Yeah, so I mean, I thought twice about writing it just because it was so illegal. and 27 years on, you still sort of think that there's going to be some gendarme somewhere who's going to be going, you know, he's just tuned into this thing he's heard of called Drive Nation, and he goes on and he reads that, and I don't know. It was...
Is there a statute of limitations on speeding?
I hope so. I could, of course, be lying about all of it as well. It could not have worked. It could all be entirely untrue. Believe me, if anybody ever knocks on my door, that's what I'll be saying. Okay, so if you've not seen it on Drive Nation, this was in a bit of context. So in 1993, Ford were making some really rubbish cars. The Sierra was at the end of its life. The Mark IV Escort, my goodness, what a heap of rubbish that was. And we'd, on Autocar, we'd been giving them a kicking, and a very well-deserved kicking for a very long time. And then they came up with this thing called the Mondeo, which they said was going to be the next big thing. And I didn't really believe it. I didn't believe it until the launch was in Saint-Tropez in, I think, January of 1993. And they rang up and they said, would you like us to send a lorry round onto which you can load all this car's competitors and we'll take it to the south of France for you? Now, I've never heard a manufacturer do that before or since. And you wouldn't do that unless you were absolutely, utterly... I mean, manufacturers hate people turning up at their launches with rival cars anyway. And there they were offering to pay to get the rival cars there. So that made me think, okay, this could be different. And then when we got there, instead of the usual, you know, half a dozen marketing men, you know, just spouting a very well-rehearsed script, there were engineers all over the place, none of them having been told what they could or could not say to us. And so kind of before we drove the car, we knew it was going to be a bit different. And it did. It kind of completely changed that and then the focus.
change the way that Ford is perceived in the UK, in Europe, and to an extent around the world. But we still felt the need to subject this Mondeo to some kind of ultimate test. And someone, I'd like to think me, possibly me, can't remember, had the idea of driving this car 10,000 miles and doing it in a week, a proper marathon. And it was obvious to us early on you couldn't do that in the UK for all sorts of reasons. And so we had teams of people just drive relays around Europe. So what you'd do is a new team would get, would park a car in Dover, get on the ferry to France, pick up the Mondeo from whoever had just done their stint. They'd then go back to Dover, collect the car that had been left from them while the new team headed off around Europe doing whatever it was they were doing. And the idea is that I was the road test editor at the time. My deputy was Steve Sutcliffe, who I'm sure will be known to very many of you. And that I think Steve had done a few earlier legs as well. But certainly the only involvement I had was for the sort of the glory leg, the anchor leg. And what we didn't expect was for everyone to have done so well that by the time we got into it for the final 24 hours, there was just 326 miles to do, which was no kind of challenge at all, obviously. And then one of us, again, I hope me, but knowing him, probably Steve, said, we could do 12,000 miles. 12,000 miles back then, and this is the way that we kind of thought about it, was the average annual mileage of a person with a car. That's what they did. And we thought it would be quite cool to drive a car as far in 1 week as a person would normally drive it in a year. I think it's London to Auckland, almost exactly.
Wow.
Or London to Tokyo and back is another way I looked at it. And you know, this wasn't like a 24 valve 3 liter. This was a 1.6 liter 90 horsepower Mondeo L saloon. It was absolutely as bargain basement as a Mondeo has got then. And you know, I think we did the maths, and I think we realised we had to average 97. I think we knew that there was basically no chance of doing it. But
so let me just clarify: that's 97 miles per hour. They had to average. Yeah. With fuel stops, inclusive, with toilet breaks.
Inclusive of everything. Literally, from the moment we got into the car, at that 24 hours, yeah, 97 miles an hour. 97 yeah. point something. Anyway, so I don't think for a moment that either of us thought we could do it, but frankly, the alternative was just getting bored stiff and going home, and in briefly being journalists, thinking that the last leg of this story, the heroic, that was going to be, you know, we drive it the equivalent distance to sort of Manchester and back. Which just, I mean, I just didn't want the story to end that way. So we embarked on this insane jaunt, promptly ran out of fuel. Steve had put a jerry can in the boot, thank God, so that didn't delay us too much. And yeah, we did Calais to Lyon in 4 hours. We were in Montpellier 2 hours after that. I think we averaged 104, because we started in the evening, so we did this all at night. We averaged 104 on a car with a top speed of probably not much more than 114, I would think. I don't know. From Calais to the south of France. The fuel stops were quite good fun because you're only allowed to pee every other stop. So the deal was that
That would be a problem for me.
Well, you could have taken a catch tank with you. We didn't need to do that, actually. Not once did anybody that I'm aware of relieve themselves actually in the car. But the deal was that, don't forget, we were getting through the gas quite quickly. So okay. We were stopping quite often. Because I think we got to do 14 to the gallon.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's good going.
That was good going. So the deal was one person filled, the other peed, grabbed sandwiches, Red Bull or whatever you had back then, and then waited for a thumbs up from the bloke doing the filling. They then paid immediately, ran back out of the car, and off you went. And as I think I said in the piece in Drive Nations, there were stops where you get in the car, red line it through first, second, third and fourth, turn into fifth, put your foot down, and the next time you'd lift would be for the next fuel station. I was trying to remember. And it was one of the joys of Drive Nation is the pieces are so short, you don't have the space to put this sort of stuff in. I was trying to remember where we actually went. Because I know we obviously went from Calais to the south of France by the traditional route. And I know we went to Bordeaux. And I know we were in Clermont-Ferrand at one stage. And I know we were very worried about traffic in Lyon. So we must have been to Lyon at least twice, because on the way down, we would have been there in the middle of the night. So that wouldn't have bothered us. And I know that we overshot considerably on the way back because, we just hadn't done enough miles. We thought we'd get back to Calais at 12,000 miles. We hadn't. So I think we had to turn around and go halfway back to Reims. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing was just made up on the spot. But the absolute God's honest truth, which no one believes, and I completely accept that that's fine because I wouldn't believe it myself, but it is true, is that we did it with 90 seconds to spare.
Unbelievable.
The 23 hours, 58 and a half minutes.
Yeah.
We did our 2,000... So we did 2,326 miles in 24 hours.
Yeah, okay, so you just scraped it.
We scraped it, yeah. We absolutely scraped it. And you'd think we'd be whooping for joy at the end of it and, you know, slapping ourselves on the butt. No, I think we just looked appalled. because once you embark on something like that, particularly if you've got a character like Steve, who is a fairly sort of never say die kind of bloke, you don't want to be the one who pulls the pin and say, no, come on, this is really stupid. We really, really shouldn't be. I mean, what are we doing here? It's just a bloody car magazine. It's just a story. You know, we'll make it up. We'll protect... Not the sort of conversations that you can really have. And neither of us wanted to be the one to go, this really is stupid. And so by the end of it, when it was over, it wasn't even relief. It was just... The only relief was, thank God, I'll never have to do anything like this ever again.
I bet.
And I haven't, and I won't.
That's, okay, so I want to know much more. What state was the car in after those 12,000 miles?
You can imagine we didn't have time to wash it or anything. In fact, we didn't want to wash it. We wanted to photograph a really clean car at the beginning and a really grimy one at the end. So in terms of the way it looked horrendous, as you can imagine. It had a year's worth of grime on it. Mm. But it was going really well.
I'm sure it was nicely run in by the end of that.
It was superb. It had done 500 miles when it got to us. I think it had just had its first oil. I think they just changed the oil and chucked it at us. And back then, servicing intervals were much shorter. We went straight past that. I remember we had to get someone to call Ford to ask them when we knew we were going to go past 10,000 miles, whether we could blow its service interval by 2,000 miles, and they weren't bothered at all, so we did that. It was just really, really crisp. It revved all the way through to the red line, which wouldn't do very happily right at the beginning. Gearbox had loosened up. It was a really nice car. And what did they do with it? So Ford took it back and immediately took it back to Dunton and stripped it because they were interested to see what an engine that had been subjected to that kind of pressure. I can't remember, but I did calculate how long the car was stationary for in that week. And it was a couple of hours or something like that.
Well, that's it. It's simply not resting, is it, for 12,000 miles?
Absolutely. And it was, you know, it was pretty much... I mean, some teams were... a bit more sensible. Every team was more sensible than us, but some teams were more sensible than others and just went quite quickly. There's one team that did 10 countries, another team that went to the far end of Portugal, and I mean, you know, just crazy, crazy stuff. So Ford wanted to have a look at it, and they did. It then went to the National Motor Museum. It had its own little display for a bit. And then I think some idiot sold it. Somebody actually responded to the story on DN, and said that it had had an MOT up until 2007.
Amazing.
And then clearly it's just gone off to the scrapper like any other car.
Put in a good shift, though.
Put in a good shift, yeah, but gosh, I'd like it still to be out there.
So I'm really intrigued to know, how honest were you in the autocar story at the time about that final stint, 2,000 and something miles?
The only lie we told... and we were told to tell this lie, was that we took a third person with us. Because we just thought, even in 1993, that it's just... You can't own up to two people having done that. Because you can imagine how much sleep either of us got. Steve and I used to do some really quite stupid stuff together. I can remember we once... Peter Robinson, Autocar's one time very, very esteemed European editor, otherwise known, in my view, as the greatest motoring journalist who's ever been born, used to live in Brescia. And he always used
to... In Italy.
In Italy. And he always used to be very proud of how long it took him to drive from Brescia to the office in Teddington. And we were going to see him. In fact, we were going to go and chase the Mille Miglia. And Steve and I managed to get a Dodge Viper for this, an early car, a roadster. And we picked it up from the importers in Dover, where we realised we had the choice of, we could take our luggage or the roof, but not both. So in the end, we left the roof behind and went out and chased one of the wettest mille millias that there's ever been in a Viper without a roof. But that's maybe a story for another podcast. But we did drive this Viper overnight through France quite quickly, sufficiently quickly that we did Calais to Italy in 6 hours.
Wow.
But in fact, that was far more relaxed than the Mondeo, because we were never driving it flat out. We always had something up our sleeves. Mm. Whereas the Mondeo was just as fast as you can go.
Those days are long gone, aren't they?
I mean, part of my reticence about posting the story was, I can't, you know, it's almost a dream. It's really quite hard. If you think about doing that today, A, the traffic wouldn't allow you to do it. B, obviously, the consequences of getting caught to it are unimaginable. And actually, being briefly sensible, I just think it was a really stupid thing to do. Mm. The Mondeo thing in particular. And I look back, and as I said, you know, I use the word appalled, you know, advisedly. I am, there's clearly quite a large chunk of me that's quite proud of it, and probably inappropriately proud of it. But there's another bit of me which just thinks, you bloody idiots. Something really bad could have happened.
It's a great story. I'm glad you posted about it on DN, but it's not something you'd try now, is it? I mean,
I wouldn't.
An amazing post. Got a really good response to that one. So let's move on to another post that got a good response. Aston Martin released some images of the Valkyrie testing on the public road for the first time.
Yeah.
Now, the Valkyrie situation is interesting. There were some whispers a few weeks ago that Aston was struggling to homologate the car so much that it might not be made road legal. Well, anyone who was peddling that rumour has been made to look a little bit daft.
Yeah.
So fair play to Aston Martin on that one. Now, what did you think of the way the car looked on the road? Did you must have seen the pictures.
Yeah, I saw the pictures. It's just the number plate, isn't it?
Yeah, the front number plate is a little bit uncomfortable. Yeah.
I mean, it's really interesting. It's cars always look different on the road, don't they? Mm. Suddenly they get a context, which they never have. Even when you see them on a racetrack where it's just all big, wide open spaces, because we've all seen that going around Silverstone and that sort of thing, but particularly on motor shows where they are complete fishes out of water. And then suddenly on the road, I just thought it looked really cool. Mm. I just thought, you know, obviously it's been a very different thing and moving the game on and you know, this sort of once-in-a-generation car like the McLaren F1 was. But I've only really visually logged onto it in quite that way once I saw those pictures. I thought it looked absolutely amazing. It looked like something from outer space. It looked like some crazy, you know, insect from some dystopian future come to visit us on planet Earth in 2020. It was an amazing looking thing.
And it's completely churlish, of course, to point out that the front number plate looks a bit daft. And I suppose what owners are going to do is remove it and pay the fine.
Of course.
That's what they'll do. So it's not going to be a problem.
No, it's not going to be a problem at all.
How many sleepless nights do you think Adrian Newey has stressing over the number plate placement and the effect that has on aero?
Oh, massive. Massive. From what I know of Adrian and from what I have heard from Aston Martin of what he is like to work for, I mean, there's perfectionism and then there's Adrian Newey.
Newey-ism.
Yeah, a Newey-ism. And, you know, he doesn't like to be bothered by things. Well, no, he is bothered by, you know, he looks at the rules and the regulations in a completely different way to normal people. Normal people look at rules and regulations and they think, well, these are things which we need to comply with. And he looks at them in terms of things where we absolutely need to not comply with these, but to do so in a way that we can't get pinged for.
It's that Formula One mindset, isn't it?
Yeah. It's not breaking the rules, it's just bending them, and that's how Newey has, you know, his genius is that's what he has done right through his career. And you know, I think some race car designers, sort of Colin Chapman and that sort of thing, are real sort of freehand artists, and they have amazing ideas and they come up with these incredible innovations that have never been done before in that field, and would therefore benefit from a very, very open set of regulations. And then there are guys like Adrian, who the thicker the rule book, the better they get, because there's just more stuff for them to get into and think, well, okay, that's going to hold them back because they won't have thought about doing it this way. And then that's what Adrian does. And that's why I'm really excited about Valkyrie, because I know it's an irrelevance and I know that it's it's a rich man's plaything. But I just love anything which does stuff which hasn't been done before.
Absolutely agree.
And I think it is, you know, again, I wrote the road test on the McLaren F1 back in, whenever it was, 94.
The only magazine road test of the McLaren F1.
Yeah, I mean, that was quite a big campaign because we were the only magazine doing proper road tests at the time. I mean, Autocar would certainly argue that that remains the case. I don't know anybody else who goes to anything like that level of rigour to get objective data on cars in the world of motoring journalism in the UK, certainly. And so our pitch to McLaren was not, can we do this? It was, we have to do this. You know, we are the only people who can do this. You need a set of objective numbers and, you know, who else are you going to go to? And because Gordon gets it, that's what happened.
So that 0-60, 0-62 time?
0-60, 3.2 seconds.
That's your time.
Yeah.
I've known of that 3.2 second figure for... No, it last year, it was 25 years since you did it, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly.
It was 1994.
I'll tell you exactly what it was. I'll tell you the day. It was May the 2nd, 1994. And I know that exactly. Only because of the day after Senna got killed.
Yes. Yeah, there we go. So, I've known of that 3.2 second figure for 20 plus years.
Yeah.
And that's your time.
0-100, 6.3, 0-228. All I would say is we had to patch it slightly, only because you can't do, you know, Millbrook is where you'd normally go to do those sorts of numbers. But you can't do 200 miles an hour at Millbrook. And we needed a 0-200 time. And so the only way place we could get at the time a 0-200 time was at Bruntingthorpe.
Yeah.
But the surface at Bruntingthorpe then as now was rubbish. And you'd never get... I mean, I think we tried it. And I was driving it and John the Palmer was driving it. And we were getting sort of late threes. Early fours, maybe. I mean, the car was way off. I mean, first gear was basically redundant. Mm-hmm. And so what we did do, and I think this is legitimate and fine, is we did, I can't remember where we split it, but I think we did 0-2, whatever we could do at Millbrook, 140, and then just took the 140 to 200 times from Bruntingthorpe and spliced them on the top, which is, I think, entirely legitimate because they were, all runs were done in two directions on a level surface. So, yeah, that's fine. I defend that. But, yeah.
So it's really interesting that I had in my notes that I wanted to ask you about, having spoken to you about the Valkyrie, I wanted to ask you about the McLaren F1. I didn't even have to prompt you. You went there anyway. Because, quite rightly, Valkyrie seems like the spiritual successor to the McLaren F1, the only car that really merits that comparison.
It is that once-in-a-generation car. And, you know, the only other contender, I guess, is the, what are we calling it these days? The Mercedes AMG 1, what was the Project 1. I know they're having problems with that car,
yeah,
with homologating it. And given that they're trying to homologate a 1,000 horsepower, 1.6 litre Formula 1 engine, then, you know, and presumably they have to WLTP that as well.
Unbelievable.
Which is an entire... you know, world of pain they wouldn't have envisaged at the get-go. So I completely understand and sympathise why that might be quite late. And I did ask the new boss of Mercedes-Benz, Ole Källenius, when we had a telephone interview at Geneva, where things were with that car and when we're going to see it. And he was, in his very charming way, he just sort of sidestepped it and said, it'll appear when it's ready to appear.
Mm.
And I said, there hasn't been much noise about it. And he said, the car makes lots of noise.
sure. Less once it's been WLTP'd.
Yeah, well, maybe. Valkyrie is on the road. That is also, it has been delayed, but I don't think to the same extent. Mm.
And it's with customers before the end of the year.
Apparently so. And I guess, like all of us, I just hope we get to drive it.
Yeah, I mean, we're quite used to seeing new cars come along and looking forward to the day that we get behind the wheel. I'm not sure that necessarily applies to the Valkyrie. I mean, they're not going to do a launch with a load of motoring press at Portimao, are they? I mean, it's going to be totally different...
I have no idea what they're going to do. I mean, all the cars, I understand it, are gone. I think there is an argument for not even doing a launch, because then you keep it mysterious and you maintain that mystique. I hope they don't. buy that argument because that would be sad. I'm sure now, I'm sure that they will do a very, very limited program. I mean, clearly they're going to want it on Top Gear.
Yes.
Clearly they're going to want, you know, Clarkson and that lot to have sight of it. And hopefully, you know, one or two of the key motoring media.
We know of an interesting Instagram project. Two founders who would be delighted to spare some time.
Absolutely, yes. I can confirm my availability on that date, whenever that date may be.
Okay. There's one more post that I want to ask about. But before that, I want to ask you one more question. You spoke about the road test on the McLaren F1. Who was present on that day?
There were a few people from the magazine, but from McLaren, there was Gordon Murray, there was Jonathan Palmer. Ron definitely wasn't there. There were obviously some technicians around. We had two F1s. We actually used three F1s for the road test. So there was XP4, which was a blue prototype, which we used for the numbers. There was XP5, which was the last prototype, which is the car that McLaren still has, and which I very, very, very luckily managed to drive quite recently, which we used for all the road assessments and all the photography. And then for some reason, they wanted another car for the cover shoot. Mm. And so days later, I went down to the Longcross test track in Chobham, and they produced a customer car, which I think was chassis 003, and I just did the cover there on that. So what was your question?
Who was present on the day? Who was present? The fascinating thing is, this is the day after Ayrton Senna was killed. McLaren's most famous driver won three world championships with the team.
Yes.
The most famous racing driver probably there has ever been. The day after he was killed, you were doing this.
The man who designed his championship winning cars, Jonathan Palmer. And you know, Jonathan will tell you that Ayrton was his absolute hero. I mean, there's professionalism and there's professionalism. I mean, you know, obviously he died on a Sunday. I mean, I turned up to Bruntingthorpe the following morning, probably more than half expecting them not to be there. Mm. But I hadn't had a call. I didn't want to call because I didn't want to jinx it. And they were, you know, they were just completely professional. We sort of mumbled out, you know, how sorry we were and that sort of thing. And we were all absolutely devastated. Mm. And it's a weird thing. Well, it is for me, at least, because, you know, there are drivers that I admire today. The drivers I really like. I mean, I admire Lewis hugely. Who wouldn't? I like guys like Max and Leclerc because they've got sort of fighting spirit. But I didn't. And it might be an age thing. It may be because back then they lived in a more difficult, dangerous time. But I didn't sort of, you know, they weren't, these guys today, they're not my heroes. Mm. I don't idolise them. But Senna, all of us in the autocar office, we were absolutely not for six by it. Hardly any of us had ever met him. And yet we all felt his passing in a way that, you know, certainly in my career in motoring journalism, there's not been anything like it. Mm. And there were the McLaren guys who, you know, who knew this bloke like a brother. And there they were the next day with the car, doing what they said they would do, getting through it. And it was, yeah, it was profoundly impressive.
It really is a measure of all those blokes, isn't it? Incredible, really. Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to the final post that I want to talk about, the final part of this podcast. And it's a huge story, actually. Andrew has driven the new Defender, Land Rover Defender, and we can now talk about it. He can tell you what it's like. So, Andrew, I'm going to sit back, cross my arms, and just listen.
Golly, okay. So, Defender. Everybody comes at it from a different direction, don't they? I mean, I've got friends who live in London, and they've got a Defender, and I don't think it's ever been outside the M25.
Yeah.
That's just, they've got a short wheelbase, nicely kitted out, 90 station wagon, and they just tool around London in it because, well, certainly until the ULEZ came in, that was kind of, you know, what they wanted to do. It was purely a fashion accessory. And then there's me. I mean, I still have the 1981 Series 3 in which I pass my test in my shed, and I still use it most weeks, and it's, you know, it's very much still the working vehicle it was designed to be. And so, you know, you have those two poles, and you try and design a car to keep both happy.
Exactly right.
You can't do it. also one which is compliant,
yep.
Yeah, which crashes the way that it should crash, not the way that Series 3s crash, you just can't do it. So, you know, I always thought it was the ultimate poison chalice. And I kind of... I couldn't understand how they were going to square that circle. And I think they have been quite exceptionally clever, because what they have done effectively is come up with a new Defender, but they've actually replaced two cars. Because the overwhelming thought that I had was not actually whether this deserves to be, you know, thought of as being the new Defender, because it is so different. Because it rides and it handles and it stops and it steers and it behaves like, you know, a modern car should behave. So in all those regards, it's nothing like a Defender. And anybody who is kind of hoping that it would be somehow is just deluding itself, because that's literally not possible and certainly not desirable. But it does have character. Not Defender character, because I think that's gone these days. Mm. You know, cars like that... And it's the reason people love classic cars, and me as much as any of them, their character derives from them not being very good cars. And they need your help. You have to get involved. You know, you have to constantly correct their steering. Maybe their brakes don't work very well. Maybe they're difficult to change gear or whatever. You're always doing stuff. You're always managing the vehicle. That means you're stuck in and you're involved. And that's where the character comes from. You don't do any of that stuff in modern cars. Mm. It's point and square. So... you know, how do you engineer that character into a brand new car like a Defender? And I think that as far as you could reasonably expect them to have done, that is what they have done. Mm. And I think that it does, as much as it could replace the old Defender, but I think more importantly, and this is the second car I'm talking about, all those people who took one look at the Discovery 5, you know, when owning their Discovery Thors, and thought, well, that's not what I wanted. That's not what I thought I was buying into. That's not a Discovery. Well, it's now called a Defender.
Mm.
You know, you could buy a tricked-up long wheelbase. You get a Defender with a 3-litre petrol engine in it. You know, and you'll pay 75 grand for that, but you could drop 75 grand into a Discovery without too much trouble. And you'll get a car that is, you know, quiet, well-equipped, but still a proper workhorse.
Mm.
Or you could do what I would do and just get literally a poverty-spec short wheelbase car on steel wheels and just go yomping in it, and it would still be good enough to, you know, go as far as you like for as long as you like and not get on your nerves.
It's interesting, and you've driven it off-road as well, and I think you said it was pretty exceptional in the...
Yeah, it was exceptional. I mean, you always sort of, you know, first, you know, this is just old road testing procedure. You always look at the data first. And the data is, you know, if you look at approach angles, departure angles, breakover angles, wading, all that sort of stuff. Its wading depth is 900 millimetres, which is as good as any other Land Rover. In every other respect, it's better. Mm. It'll just do more stuff. But when you drive it off-road, I mean, I've been over the toughest things... the Eastner Castle, where they develop these cars, can offer places which the chap who was with me was saying that if you tried 20 years ago, you'd need a military vehicle and a winch before even thinking about going in there. What was far more impressive to me was how easy it made it. You know, it's possible, I suppose, that if you're a professional off-road driver, you could get an old Defender up some of those muddy, rock-strewn, root-strewn hills, don't know. But with the Defender, what it does, this might sound a little bit antiseptic and clinical, but it's the speed at which it thinks. So when you've got to that bit where you lose traction and the car, you can feel the car slowing down, and you can feel the car's system thinking, oh shit, maybe a little bit more torque there, maybe break that wheel, and all the time you're slowing down. The Defender doesn't do that. It thinks so fast. It just stays ahead of the curve. And so you never lose that momentum. So you keep going. You're never aware of the car grappling with a problem. It just does it. And I couldn't believe what it would go over. Mm. You know, it was... And it has to be, doesn't it? I mean, God, come on. I mean, you know, it would be like... you know, Ferrari coming up with a new LaFerrari, which wasn't quite as fast as the old one. I mean, yes. you know, job one was to make sure that it would be the most capable off-roader probably anybody had ever produced, certainly the Land Rover ever produced. And, you know, I'm no off-roading expert, but from what I've... I mean, I have never done off-roading in a car more extreme than that. And I've certainly never been more comfortable in a car while doing off-roading as extreme as that. So, yeah, it does that.
And then it marries that remarkable off-road ability with pretty civilised on-road manners, personally.
Yeah, I mean, as you will read, depending on when you are listening to this or have read, I was asked, because understandably the PR man couldn't help himself, what I thought of it. And literally the words that came to my mind was, I'm a bit worried it's not quite shit enough. and this sort of harks back to what I was saying about the involvement thing and old cars and that sort of thing, because, you know, it is the sort of car that you want to get stuck into. And I'm sure that if you spend a lot of money and you've got the big petrol engine and lots of equipment, you could have an incredibly civilized Defender. A Defender which was probably, in most ways that matter, you know, not a lot less civilized than a Discovery. Mm. But I, funnily enough, I drove it both on the all-season and on the all-terrain proper off-road tyres on the road. And I just preferred it on the road on the off-road tyres because it was just a bit more wobbly and a bit more vague. And it felt a bit more like I kind of remember Defenders feeling.
Mm, okay, a bit more distinctive, a bit more character.
A bit more distinctive, a bit more character. A bit worse, clearly. Yeah. A bit more shit. Mm. But that's all right.
So overall then, the job they've done on the new Defender, smashed it?
Yeah.
Could do more?
Well, God knows, no car's perfect. They could do lots more. It doesn't have, you know, I was kind of hoping that there'd be some, you know... My old Series 3, it's got, you know, it's got levers and handles and all sorts of that. And I would have liked to have seen some more of that on the Defender. It doesn't really have very chunky switch gear. It's got TFT screens, you know, high definition screens. I just want clocks. Now, I know that, you know, these things aren't very practical in the modern era and you've got to use stuff that you can use across all your platforms. But I would have just preferred a little bit more of a head and onto that sort of thing. But, you know, within reason and given the, frankly, almost impossible job that they're asking it to do, yeah, I would say not beyond my wildest dreams, but as good as I think any reasonable person could hope and expect it to be.
I'm so looking forward to driving this car. I haven't done so yet. Can you give us a rating out of 10?
I think I gave it a 9. Sorry. I mean, goodness knows, I wanted to give it a 10. I was kind of really thinking, could I? Because it would only be the second one that we'd ever done.
Yeah.
For those people who are not familiar with the Instagram Drive Nation, like all people who review cars, we have a verdict and a rating. But our ratings are a bit different insofar as if you're absolutely the best car in your category, you may still only get a 9. To get a 10, you need to change the game. You need to do it in a completely different way and in a way that genuinely sheds proper light on whatever discipline it is that you're attempting. And so far, the Alpine A110 is the only car that we have tested which we felt deserved that. And yeah, the Defender, I'd love to have done, goodness knows, I'd love to give that a 10. But no, sorry.
Okay, 9. Well, that means it's still a remarkable car. And it's interesting that you should mention the Alpine A110 because... as I look over my shoulder through the window, I can see my own Alpine A110. We'll save that one for the next podcast. But we'll leave it there for now. That's our Drive Nation pilot podcast done and dusted. Andrew, thank you.
Not at all. It's been fun. Frankly, it's been more fun than I thought it was going to be. But you're much more averse in tune with these things than I am. And, you know, all I would say is please bear with us. This was our first stab at it. Obviously, there was a lot of introductory stuff we had to get out of the way first. And by the time we sit down to do this again, if that's what you want us to do, we'll have lots more ideas from you of stuff that you want us to be talking about. And hopefully we will be better at it. But I certainly enjoyed it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's been a fun thing to do. I just hope you guys think it was a worthwhile thing to do as well.
Exactly right. So... The important thing now really is feedback from you guys. So let us know what you think, good and bad. Also, this stuff really does matter. Please leave a little review on whatever podcast app or platform you use. Positive reviews, I mean. Give us a rating.
There aren't going to be any negative ones.
Give us a rating, please. Tell your friends. Let us know what you think about this podcast. If you enjoyed it, we'll really seriously look at making it a regular thing. But for now, thank you. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye from me. Cheers.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.